What I remember is when he introduced Stevie. He introduced his world's greatest guitar player, Stevie Ray Vaughan. And when he played his first note, it sounded like he bent the string farther than there was fretboard. It was like the fretboard had been like 4 feet wide. This note just like went, it just shot out. And it was like amazing. Because once again, I remember thinking, just like the very first time I ever heard Stevie, it was like you could hear the band, but all of a sudden you just heard this guitar. And this one note was like bigger than everything else that was going on.
Hi, this is Tommy Shannon.
And I'm Chris Layton. In the studio for the best of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble.
While on tour in Europe in 1986 with his band Double Trouble, Texas blues singer-guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan collapsed and was hospitalized near death, first in London and then in a Georgia substance abuse clinic. Double Trouble bass player Tommy Shannon checked into a detox facility back home in Austin, Texas at the very same time. The dream of playing nonstop for everyone, everywhere, had turned into a nightmare. And the gravity of Vaughn's and Shannon's medical conditions pulled the large touring and recording machine to a merciful halt. Meanwhile, Double Trouble drummer Chris Layton and keyboard player Reese Winans were saddled with trying to salvage botched live recordings into a stopgap live album. After lengthy hospitalizations and months of rehab for both Stevie Vaughan and Tommy Shannon, they both rejoined the band. But the real test of their newly found sobriety would be the numbing monotony of the road. Double Trouble drummer Chris Layton follows bass player Tommy Shannon in the studio.
I remember my first gig sober with Stevie, and I was terrified. You know, I looked out there and saw all those people. I mean, my heart was going like this. I was terrified. And I was thinking, God, boy, I need a drink. But I went ahead and went out there and went through it. And after a period of time, you know, I got used to it. I mean, it felt different. Everything about it was different. You know, there wasn't that sloppy abandon myself and just do all that. There, you know, it's kind of like as we went on, I had to discipline myself, you know, work on my techniques, sit down and do these petty exercises and stuff. And I started wanting to become a better musician.
I remember being a little bit frightened, but at the same time had this confidence in everybody, always known everybody in this band to be people that didn't do things unless they really meant them. And for the fact that everybody had decided to, or said come to this point in their life to turn their life around, that they would have never gotten there if they didn't plan on staying there. I think you, Tommy, had told me that how many people who become or inner recovery don't actually stay there, and they fall back into drinking or doing whatever their drug of choice was. I thought I was kind of amazed by it, because out of everybody in the organization that entered recovery, everybody's still there, and it's like 100%, where it's like the success rate was so small. And I thought, well, it didn't surprise me that everybody was still sober, because I just figured wouldn't have done it if it didn't mean it.
Yeah, it's like when we came back to work, you know, being clean and sober at first, two of the guys in our crew had gotten clean and sober also. And, you know, it's like there's all kinds of support. You know, the whole emphasis was on sobriety, you know. And it used to be back when we were high all the time, there'd be drugs and alcohol and all kinds of people. Anybody who had drugs could get in. And it changed from that to people who had the same goals as us, you know, staying clean and sober.
Yeah.
While Stevie and Tommy Shannon had been in rehab hospitals prior to making the Instep album, the downtime had a positive effect on Double Trouble drummer Chris Layton.
And then right at that point when they went into treatment, I mean, I stopped doing everything for a few months. Started working out and getting real healthy and swimming and doing all this stuff, and I started feeling great. I thought, wow, what a change from the life that I had been leading.
One thing, you know, it was going to be our first album, Clean and Sober, and Stevie, he was real afraid, you know, tackling this, Clean and Sober. And as a matter of fact, I was too. We both had the same fear that it might not work. It was very frightening. It really was. Because in the back of your head, you're going, well, what if this doesn't work when we're sober, you know? It turned out, I think, to be our best record.
Joe Nick Potosky, co-author of the Stevie Ray Vaughan biography Caught in the Crossfire, claims that one of the main players in the second act of the Stevie Ray Vaughan story is songwriter Doyle Bramhall.
Doyle is one of the great role models for Stevie Ray Vaughan, probably more so than anyone other than Jimmy Vaughan. Stevie was never a very prolific songwriter. And in fact, I mean, he was as much an interpreter as he was an original composer. And I think when push came to shove and it was time to come up with some material, he found great comfort in Doyle. Things clicked. And I think that was the one area where there was some real positive benefits out of the Soul to Soul session, is it really solidified his relationship with Doyle as a songwriting team. It continued into the up into the end, and I think Doyle was also an inspiration as someone who had overcome his chemical dependencies. He'd done it before it was cool. When Stevie decided to get his own head straight, Doyle was there to offer not only support as a lyricist, but also as a friend. And someone who had walked a mile in Stevie's shoes.
Here's Doyle Bramhall, the composer of such Stevie Ray Vaughan staples as Change It, Looking Out the Window, The House is Rockin', Tightrope, and Wall of Denial.
His favorite guitar player in the whole wide world was his big brother.
Definitely.
But he's, you know, on the record, he's told many people that his vocal styles, that he copped them straight from you.
Being in bands with Jimmy, I mean, Stevie would come out to gigs and sit there, and he always wanted to know how things worked, how, you know, we can go to the store and he'd be reading boxes of stuff. He wouldn't buy anything, unless he looked and saw what was on it. And that's the way he was about music. That's the way he was about, when we would get off stage, he would go, hey, Doyle, how do you do this? And this is before he was singing, and I would say, well, let's just sit down, and we'd mess around. And so for years, it got to the point where he would come up, or he'd call me on the phone, and he would just have this riff, vocal riff that we had talked about, or I had sung to him on the phone as he was in New York or somewhere. He would call back, and he would do the same thing and go, I think I got it. And so, but then it got to the point. I mean, it was interesting because Stevie, everybody knows how great of a guitar player Stevie is.
Yes.
But he was also a great singer.
See,
I mean, if you listen to his voice.
Amen, brother. That's my point that I'm getting to, is that Jimi Hendrix, God, everybody knows that God gave that man talents with the guitar. But I'm telling you, I think Stevie Ray Vaughan was a better singer than Jimmy ever was.
Well, Hendrix probably would have said that.
I think
Hendrix
would have.
He didn't like his voice.
Well,
he didn't like the way he sang.
He sang well enough,
yeah.
But I think Stevie Ray Vaughan was the total package.
Well, he was, and like I said, his energy, his personality, his guitar playing. But if you sit down and listen to his singing, and listen to where he goes, you know, what he does with his vocals, it's very creative too.
It is, but there's a million other blues and rock singers that he could have studied, and I'm sure he soaked up many of them. But
right.
Predominantly, it's you, Doyle Bramhall, that he emulated. Where did your vocal chops come from? Mom, Dad, gospel singing, other blues singers. Where did you get your vocal styling?
Early on, I think the first people I really started listening to and really grabbed me were Fats Domino, Little Richard. Ray Charles was a huge.
Wow.
My older brother Ronnie had this great blues collection back in high school in the early 60s.
Yeah, I'll say.
And he and about five guys from Irving would get together every fifth week or whatever and come to our house. And they would play all these great records. And, you know, of course, Muddy Waters, B.B. King, Tyrone Davis, Al Green, Sly Stone, Bobby Womack. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Howlin' Wolf. I couldn't even believe that guy. When I first heard him, it kind of, I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
But you
not a white guy in the bunch, though. You just rattled off about 10
names.
Well,
I can name white guys, too.
Well, I'm just saying that.
But early on, you know, and I just, again, felt so fortunate to have been around a person like Stevie. But he and I both would sit down with all these, with the records, the people I just named, and just play them over and over and over and over. And I've got the people in my life that influence my vocal style and my drumming style. And Stevie had, you know, and I'm honored, you know, that I was one of the influences on him as far as singing. I do know that he liked, you know, got stuff from other people too.
Well,
but
sure.
But I'm very humbled and honored.
Looking back in front of me, the mirror's a grin. Through eyes of love I see, I'm really looking at a friend. We fall out of problems, the way life is. My heart goes out to others, we're there to make amends. We've been walking the tightrope, trying to make it right. Every day and every night, walking the tightrope.
Coming up next, Stevie Ray Vaughan's rehab hospitalization intervened to save his life from certain death. But how would it affect his music? Find out. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and find out a lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the 10th anniversary of the Grammy Award-winning fourth album from Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble, In Step. In Step, the Grammy Award-winning fourth studio album from Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble. I'm Redbeard, and the obvious question, after Stevie Ray Vaughan's rehab hospitalization intervened to save his life from what would have been most certainly death, would be how would it affect his music? Double Trouble bass player Tommy Shannon answers first, followed by drummer Chris Layton.
I thought he was playing better, you know, a lot more tasteful, and I thought his vocals improved tremendously. I think his vocals on that record were definitely the best.
Yeah, his whole singing got incredibly better, and his guitar playing did too. He got more concise. What he felt, and what he was able to say with his guitar was more connected than it ever had been. I mean, he would say that too beforehand. It was like he would like just kind of do all kind. He could do anything. It always sounded good. And that's what he said he would, you know, tend to do. You know, play too many notes or, you know, whatever, and maybe it really wasn't what he wanted to do, but he connected up with everything. All his feelings and thoughts, everything connected much more with what actually came out.
Day by day, night after
it's the song Crossfire from Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble's In Step album, with some heavyweight lyrics that pack a wallop in confronting the temptation, seduction, and denial of substance abuse. With those issues successfully behind him, writer Stephen Thomas Erlewine points out on AllMusic.com that, quote, "The magnificent thing about In Step is how it's fully realized, presenting every facet of Vaughan's musical personality, yet it still soars with a sense of discovery," end quote. Bluesman Joe Bonamassa told me that Stevie Ray Vaughan's talent transcended the blues idiom.
I think Stevie's gift was he was able to communicate with everybody. There's a lot of great guitar players, and there's arguably gazillion that have come before and have come since. But Stevie's legacy, I think, really is he was the guy who could put on a guitar, any guitar, play three notes, and have people instantly hooked and going, something really cool is going on here. And that you can't teach. That was that's a inherent talent that he had. He also had the ability to select songs that also communicated with people, and also not only communicated with, you know, straight blues fans, but people who weren't outside the blues. They're going, I didn't know this was the blues, and I love it, you know? And having that ability to kind of like cross the line and bring everybody into the fold was really, I think, his most lasting legacy. And arguably there are more copy, you know, copiers of Stevie Ray than there are of Hendrix. And I mean, to have that, you know, to have that legacy is just, I mean, an awesome, you know, an awesome accomplishment. And, you know, it's just because everybody knows they can go out for $300 and buy a Stratocaster and an amp and have it sound, you know, reasonably like Stevie Ray Vaughan if they choose to. Not to diminish his skill on a guitar, but for them, he's everybody's guitar player.
Here's a thing off of In Step. This is a song by a good friend about Mr. Buddy Guy. Y'all like Buddy Guy? I sure do. Hello, girlfriend. You know, every once in a while, us guys, we run into that wonderful woman, you know, that makes us all crazy and shit, you know, makes it get shaky inside and stuff. And it's time to say something real good, ain't that right, ladies? You better say something right then or nothing at all. You better say something like this. Drive me crazy.
Willie Dixon's Let Me Love You Baby from Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble and the Instep album. Here's Stevie Ray Vaughan, caught in the crossfire biographer Joe Nick Petoskey with me in the studio.
Buddy Guy told me something. Buddy Guy, this is a quote. He said, Stevie Ray Vaughan had a skeleton key that unlocked all the doors for the rest of us.
And that's the truth. There's no question about that. These guys were, they were in a period of decline, and really not since the Fillmore scene in the late 60s, when Albert King and B.B. King and Buddy Guy and Junior Wells, folks like that, had really had their heyday with, as far as reaching about as broad an audience as they ever had. It had been on the decline since then, and work was harder. They were resigned to either playing clubs or working the Chitlin circuit for those few older blacks that were still smitten with the blues. But they had kind of fallen out of favor with this larger audience, and Stevie opened the door for them again.
You better leave. You better leave. Today, I picked up the extension and I heard every word you say. Why don't you just go mine and leave my little girl alone? Not before I get evil, man. Do something wrong.
Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble with Buddy Guy's Leave My Girl Alone from the In Step album, which won a Grammy in 1990 for Best Contemporary Blues Album. Still to come, the musicians who joined Stevie Ray Vaughan on stage on the final night of his life are here in the studio, including Buddy Guy, Eric Clapton, Tommy Shannon, and Chris Layton. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and find out a lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary of the Grammy Award-winning fourth album from Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble, In Step. Welcome back in the studio for the anniversary of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble's Grammy Award winner, In Step. I'm Redbeard. By the summer of 1990, Double Trouble was free to hit the road again, fresh, rested, and tapping newly found energy and sobriety. Two of the marquee dates were back-to-back nights with Eric Clapton and Robert Cray at a large open-air amphitheater between Chicago and Milwaukee known as Alpine Valley. Because the concert site was 50 miles from Chicago, where all the bands were staying, helicopters were used to shuttle the bands and their tour managers over the concert traffic in and out of Alpine Valley in the Wisconsin countryside. Bluesman Buddy Guy was there at the invitation of all three guitarists on the bill. I asked Buddy Guy if he saw Stevie Ray Vaughan play on that second night.
Well, first of all, I had to see if I saw from the first lick to the last one, because I actually wasn't on the show. They invited me up there just as a guest, so I was sitting on stage from start to finish. And I've seen him play many nights. And this particular night, he played incredible well. He played licks I had neither one of us heard before. Something about that night so special. I don't know if that's because of his death or what, but it's just something special about that night. I wish they had recorded it, because while Eric was playing, he was standing backstage talking to me, and he said, "Man, you know, we got to get you in the studio. We don't have nobody to steal licks off no more. So we're going to get you a recording contract, and we have to go in there and do it and do it ourselves." And him and Eric and Robert Cray and his brother and all of them put their arm around me and said, "You'll be recorded 40 years out."
Here is Eric Clapton's actual introduction of his musical guests at Alpine Valley that night, August 26, 1990, for what was the encore of Sweet Home Chicago.
I'd like to bring out, to join me, in truth, the best guitar players in the entire world, man. Buddy Guy, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Robert Cray, Jimmy Vaughan.
Double Trouble drummer Chris Layton watched from side stage while each of these guitarists took the spotlight in turn. Then it was Stevie who stepped up to the plate.
What I remember is when he introduced Stevie, he introduced his world's greatest guitar player, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and when he played his first note, it sounded like he bent the string farther than there was fretboard. It was like the fretboard had been like 4 feet wide, and this note just like went and just shot out, and it was like amazing. Because once again, I remember thinking, just like the very first time I ever heard Stevie, it was like you could hear the band, but all of a sudden you just heard this guitar, and this one note was like bigger than everything else that was going on. Just like that, just like this, like the first time I ever heard him, it was like right then, it was like this big note, and there it was. And he really, I mean, I thought, God, I got these chill bumps. It was like this thing ran up my spine. I went, what is going on? Because I mean, I never heard him play a note like that, quite like that.
Headliner Eric Clapton saw Stevie Ray Vaughan's performance that fateful night, too. Like Buddy Guy, Clapton couldn't help but notice that Stevie was in a zone that night. I asked Eric Clapton to describe what would be Stevie's last performance of his life.
Please tell me about that gig. Who all ended up on stage jamming with your band?
There was Buddy Guy, Jimmy Vaughan, Stevie Ray, And Robert, that's in Robert Cray. I mean, that to me, it
Summit
couldn't
meeting.
Have been better. It was really like a guitar player's dream, you know.
I read where you gave a kind of an assessment of Stevie Ray's performance on what turned out to be his last. Where was he as a player then?
Oh, beyond anything I can even describe. I think the best way to describe it was just to sit, to have been in my shoes in the dressing room watching the monitor. And so I could sit in my dressing room with the door open and hear him from the stage and see him on the TV, knowing that I had to go up later and play. And what was happening was I was actually so bowled over and so in love with this guy that was playing there on stage from the heart completely. you know, that I started to feel ashamed of what I was going to go and do. Because I was going to go up there and do Cream songs and do little different kinds of music. And here was one guy playing one kind of music in a one kind of way. And it made me kind of feel, well, God, are you ever going to be like this? You know, that's the way I felt. Are you ever going to get to that point, the point you're watching right now? And I don't know if that many people ever do, because I enjoy in my life playing all kinds of stuff. You know, I know I play blues probably easier than anything else. You know, everything else is a bit of a learning experience, but I do dabble around in other areas, rock and roll and country and this and that and songwriting. But none of it has that oneness that Stevie Ray had. You see, because don't forget, for me, I come from England, so my music is really an adopted music from another country. And so I'm not just affected by American music, I'm affected by European music too. It's the folk musics of my own country are instilled in me and they come up. I can't really fight it off, it's there. But to see Stevie Ray that night playing music from his own, the place where he stood and was raised on earth, from the heart, you know. And as probably the best I ever saw him, it was tremendous.
And when a musician, when he or she gets to that point, the way you've described it, they get almost transcendent.
Yeah.
In your experience, have you seen or heard others get to that point where the emotion that's in the music is almost palpable?
Very rarely. Usually it's a question of balance, a question of how many things there are in the mix. You know, whether the person is in good mental health, whether they're in good physical shape, whether their motives are clear. You know, all of these things that really wrap up the character and the embodiment of the human being with this gift and at the state of, you know, the state he's in at that time when you're seeing the performance. With all those things in question, it's a very rare experience. Now, Stevie Ray on that night and many nights before, I'm sure, had all of these things in control and was master of everything. And when I recall that night, there was nothing missing, there was no room for improvement.
After the last note of the Guitar Superstar Summit, drummer Chris Layton had the opportunity to chat with Stevie backstage while they waited for the helicopters to begin ferrying the large contingent of musicians, tour managers, agents, and assistants back to Chicago. The dense fog that had rolled into Alpine Valley that night wasn't really a topic of conversation.
The conversation was actually very light. There was nothing heavy in it. Just like, great, this is a great couple of nights, and wasn't it great to be here, and talked about, you know, the record that he and Jimmy just made. He said, yeah, talk about how, you know, they had a lot of fun and that was exciting. He was looking forward to that coming out and looking forward to us making another record. And he was in great spirits. I mean, we just had two great nights and talked about all kinds of stuff. Talked about the son that my wife and I were getting ready to have. We didn't know it was a boy, but and just anything and everything. We talked for like, I guess, almost 30 minutes. Then he got up. He said, I'm going to go back down to the dressing room for a minute. And I don't know, maybe five minutes or so later, he came back up and he had his jacket on. He had his bags. And he kind of, he was just going to walk, not right by me because it wasn't that path, but he was like making this turn. I said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm going to go back to Chicago. I said, well, now? And he said, yeah. I got to get back. I want to call Jonna. His girlfriend was in New York. And I thought, geez, he could actually call her anywhere and then call her later. I mean, this is what I was thinking. But he said, he kind of took another step and then he turned around and said, call me when you get back. And he said, I love you. And he kind of gave me that wink of the eye that he would do. And then he was gone. And that was the last time I saw him. And he just disappeared into the night.
Bass player Tommy Shannon had shuttled back to Chicago by helicopter even before Clapton's encore, while drummer Chris Layton had left on yet another helicopter much later than Stevie Vaughan. I asked Tommy when he first knew that something was terribly wrong.
I didn't find out till the next morning, and our manager, Alex Hodges, called me. Whew. I mean, I can't put in words how I felt. You know, he said, one of the helicopters went down last night that Stevie was in. They reported no survivors. And that's probably the worst moment of my entire life. I mean, we shared things we'd never tell anybody else, ever. You know, he was the best friend I ever had.
Tommy called me, said that we needed to have a band meeting. Yeah. Skip Rickards' room, our tour manager. I thought, something's not right. Band meetings. It was real late. We didn't get back to the hotel till like, got after 5, maybe 5:30 in the morning from the flight. And it was a little while later. And I walked in, everybody was starting to assemble. And I thought, oh, this is just wrong.
Yeah, 7 o'clock in the morning.
The phone rang. We got on, and I think Alex was, well, as I remembered, he was trying to be as gentle as possible, saying that he was with Roger Forrester, Eric's manager, and that one of the helicopters, the one that Stevie was on, didn't make it back. It was 98%. That's what I remember him saying, 98% certain that there was no survivors. And I thought, this can't be. I remember I went and ran and got security and made them open Stevie's door just to prove that this was like a nightmare. I remember we went and opened the door and the door opened up and the bed was untouched. It had never made it back. The radio was on like when they do turn down service, and I heard the first report of it over the radio right then as I was standing by his bed. And
of all the people touched by the tragedy at Alpine Valley that night, no one lost more than Eric Clapton. You see, along with his dear friend Stevie Ray Vaughan, that helicopter also carried away Clapton's beloved agent, Bobby Brooks, Clapton's tour manager, Colin Smythe, and Clapton's bodyguard, Nigel Brown. The local charter helicopter pilot also died. Redbeard here, thanking all my guests, and today's program is dedicated to the late Stevie Ray Vaughan, also to the late Doyle Bramhall Sr. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter. And for the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net.